Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Because of the surreal presidential race, there hasn't been that much media attention on down-ticket races, even though senators and congresspeople will determine what the next president actually accomplishes. The top 10 Senate races have seen record spending from outside groups, according to a new report from the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. Outspending political parties and candidates, outside groups have poured $282 million in key Senate elections. And then earlier this year, it was widely reported that the Koch brothers would spend almost $900 million on down-ticket races. So what's really at stake here? Well, Democrats need to keep the 46 seats they hold in the Senate and win five more to gain a majority. If voters elect Hillary Clinton, Democrats need to win four more seats, since the vice president would be the tiebreaker. And then over in the House, Republicans overwhelmingly dominate and will most likely continue to maintain party control due to partisan redistricting. Republicans also outnumber Democrats in state legislatures and governor seats across the country, also due to redistricting and gerrymandering. But for some reason, these issues aren't really getting much attention. Well, joining me to talk about these issues is David Daley. He is the publisher of the Connecticut News Project. That's a watchdog organization covering state politics and policy. David is also former editor-in-chief of Salon. He still writes there. And in his most recent book, Rat Effed, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy, he explores how Republicans are rigging democracy through redistricting. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Great to be with you again.
Well, it's great to have you, and I still love the book that you wrote, Rat Effed. You just put out so much information that I think deserves so much more attention. And you recently wrote a piece in Salon, and you call out the New York Times and other media for failing to draw attention to the effects of partisan gerrymandering in this election. And this is such an important point. You write that there's a lack of competitive seats because of the way the lines were drawn in 2011. Republicans have a powerful advantage because Republicans drew the lines that way to build themselves a legislative majority, even in the years when their candidates receive fewer votes. So first off, David, why isn't this issue getting more attention?
That is a terrific question. There is still this sense amongst the media, amongst sort of the smart set of political scientists, that we have sorted ourselves into these districts, or that Republicans have a natural advantage because of the way the lines are drawn. And all of these people are fundamentally missing the way that the redistricting and gerrymandering game changed forever in 2010 and 2011. Gerrymandering has gone on since the beginning of time, yes. Both parties have done it over time, yes. But the paradigm shifted in 2010. Republicans reinvented the gerrymander and used redistricting as a way to cement their ability to govern with a minority of the vote. And that simply has not registered in the way that the mainstream media covers these campaigns and the way that political science considers it. It's shocking to me because Republicans completely come out and admit what they did. There have been court cases after court cases in which you can read the secret emails and the depositions that are given when these mapmakers and consultants are put on the stand and forced to testify about it openly and honestly. And you can see it and you can track it, but it's not covered that way. And we are going to wake up on Wednesday morning to President Hillary Clinton, you know, unless if Donald Trump pulls the wildest inside straight anybody has ever managed to pull off in presidential history with 4 days left. But there's going to be a Republican House, despite the fact that Democratic candidates are going to get many hundreds of thousands of more votes. And these Democratic House members are already talking about impeachment. This matters.
Wow.
This is going to control the kind of politics we have in this country over the next 4 years.
David, How do you respond when the media say that this country is so divided? Over the last year, that's what we have heard over and over again, that things are so partisan and so divided.
Well, we are divided, and we certainly, when you are as divided as you are, that's what makes it so easy for partisan map makers to draw the lines. Because if you have a sense of how people vote, you can then group them. People like to say that this is the big sort theory, that gerrymandering is not the problem. It's simply that Republicans like to live around Republicans and Democrats like to live around Democrats. This may have been true up to a point. In 2010, the technology gets so good and our partisanship becomes so hardened, and the amount of public information and purchasable information about us becomes so easy to get, and the computing power is so magnificent and fast that you can move a line a block in any direction and you can understand instantaneously what the effect is going to be on the partisan makeup. So we certainly are divided. None of this is to say we're not divided. It is to say that the technology makes it possible to draw lines that with such ease and certainty, in a way that it has never been possible before. When you look at these districts, and I'd encourage your listeners, if they're not driving, to, you know, stop and Google Michigan's 14th or North Carolina's 3rd or Pennsylvania's 7th or Maryland's 3rd and take a look at them. We did not big sort ourselves into those districts. And every single line and twist and nook of these obscenely drawn districts are there for a reason. It's not simply a funny Rorschach test. It is a perversion of our democracy. And when, for the second presidential election in a row next week, more people vote for one side, but the other party retains a hammerlock on the institution that's supposed to be the most responsive to the public will, that's deeply, deeply dangerous. And the media needs to talk about it in a way that is honest and forthright and that actually calls out what is happening if we are going to have any hope of actually solving this.
And to get a sense of what some of these districts look like, if you have a child in your life, some of the districts look like a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old's drawings. They're just all over the place, right?
They look like a 2-year-old's drawing, but they are the result of the smartest strategists and intense computer power and more information than you can possibly imagine. When these lines are drawn, and they tend to be drawn with a program called Maptitude, which is what the folks in state legislatures use when they're doing this, that comes preloaded with all of the census information. So, and that's a wealth of demographics and economics and ethnicity and everything you might possibly imagine. But then there's all these public record databases that you can factor in on top of that. So voting records, what party are you in what elections do you turn out and what elections do you not turn out? Your votes aren't there, but you can break it down by precinct level. So I can tell you on your block that there were 7 votes for Barack Obama and 6 votes for Mitt Romney. So I can tell at a really granular level what is happening block by block. Then I can filter in magazine subscriptions or social media likes and a cloud's worth of consumer preferences. Break all of this down by zip code, break it all down by precinct level. When I draw these lines, I've got an obscene amount of information about each of these blocks. And I went out and I drove a lot of these districts. And when you drive them, you see up close just how specifically and precisely carved that they were.
Hmm. Now, over in the House, all 435 seats are up for re-election. For the Democrats to regain the House, they would need to flip 30 seats. But as you report, Democratic House candidates will probably get more votes than Republicans, as they did in 2012. It's important to remember that Democrats got 1.4 million more votes nationwide, but Republicans maintained a 234 to 201 advantage. What do you expect will happen on Election Day?
I think the Democrats will win a handful of seats. They will probably win somewhere between 12 and 16. There's not really a serious nonpartisan analyst who sees it as being much higher than 15. If you believe otherwise, you're probably reading an email, a fundraising pitch from Nancy Pelosi this morning. It's simply not going to happen. And the funny thing is that a lot of the seats that the Democrats are likely to pick up will be because of court-ordered redistricting, in which courts have mandated that gerrymandered districts be redrawn in Virginia and Florida. So a handful of the likely Democratic pickups are going to come there. There are a handful of seats in California. Darrell Issa certainly is a case to watch. There's a handful in New York. There are a handful of remaining suburban moderates in Minnesota and Virginia where these races ought to be looked at closely. But there are only about 17 races left that are considered toss-ups. And if you look at something like the Crystal Ball report at the University of Virginia, which is very, very highly respected, and which goes district by district and sort of breaks all of this down, they already have 225 seats solid for the Republicans. So it's 225, 193 in their count right now, with 17 toss-ups left. That means that the Democrats could win all 17 of these toss-ups, sweep the board, which is, you know, not likely. But even if they sweep the board, that's not enough. They still, in these last 5 days, have to find another 8 seats someplace that they can flip their way. It is highly unlikely. Though I think what you're going to see is that it could be more than 1.4 million more votes for Democrats this year. Breaking that record number from 2012, it is amazing to me that you can look at a state like North Carolina, which is one of the swing states this cycle, but there's not a single competitive congressional seat in North Carolina. That state will stay 10-3 Republican. You can look at Pennsylvania, which has been solidly in the blue column, with the exception of one poll back in July. You have to look really, really hard to even find a single competitive congressional race there in this cycle. Ohio is probably in the Trump side, but it's still a classic 50-50 bellwether state. There's not a single competitive congressional district in Ohio. That will stay 12-4 Republican. Michigan, you can't really find a competitive race in Michigan, even though it's a solid blue state. That will stay 9-5 Republican. And when you're staring at numbers like that in blue states and purple states that are 12-4, a 10-3, a 13-5 of the makeups of these delegations, you begin to see why the Democrats can't climb towards 218.
If you talk about North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Ohio,
yeah,
this was not the case 10 years ago?
No. I mean, at least if you look, I mean, Pennsylvania is, to me, an amazing example. I mean, Pennsylvania in 2008 elects Barack Obama, and they elect, in Pennsylvania, in 2008, there is a similar margin of victory for Barack Obama and for House Democratic candidates statewide as there is in 2012 for Barack Obama and House Democrats. In 2008, Democrats win 12 of the 19 seats in Pennsylvania. In 2012, Republicans win 13 of the 18 seats in Pennsylvania that they lost one through reapportionment. So what changes? It's not the margin of victory. It's not the number of votes. What changes is in 2010 and 2011, Republicans redrew the lines so that they packed all of those Democratic votes into as few districts as possible and took all of the remaining seats for themselves. And they drew these lines in such a way, with such sophisticated information, that they withstood a margin of 100,000 votes in 2012 and will probably withstand a larger margin in 2016. This is not healthy for democracy.
David Daly is publisher of the Connecticut News Project, a watchdog organization covering state politics and policy. He's former editor-in-chief of Salon and still writes for Salon. In his most recent book, Rat Effed, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy, David explores how Republicans are rigging democracy through redistricting. And if you'd like to join us, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. Are you hearing much about gerrymandering and redistricting in the media? What races are you paying attention to? What has caught your attention? And if you have any questions for David about how this works, how the Republicans were able to pull this off in 2010, we'd love to hear from you. And also, has your district been redrawn? Has it been gerrymandered? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can leave a comment on our website. And let's hear from David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Rose, and other David. Hey, you know, a couple of things. A few years ago when this got exposed by Greg Palast, the idea of paper ballots, provisional ballots being used. But then he's helped disclose that those paper ballots aren't being counted because they're considered too expensive to count. And so whether the budget after Election Day is being abused, and so this emergency created a fallback position, and now that fallback's not being budgeted. The other thing he raised, though, was the company choice point. And the second question I got for you is whether or not this data, this very detailed data per district, was gathered by Choice Point. Because once Greg Palast exposed this in 2000, Choice Point went on to become the biggest contract for Homeland Security for voter purging in America. They had all 50 states plus military. And if you remember, in 2004 and 2008, the military were starting to lose their right to vote thanks to Choice Point. So I'm wondering if this detailed data that is being used to gerrymander is being gathered by Choice Point or some other company, and then whether that could be looked at as misappropriation of government funds and, you know, fraud and all sorts of different things using tax dollars.
Well, thank you for the question. David, do you know?
All good questions. I am not an expert on paper ballots or the counting of any of that, so I would leave that for somebody else. I mean, Choice Point certainly is one of the absolute biggest of the data mining groups. Redistricting is done differently in every state by a different body. So I would imagine that, you know, a number of them probably are purchasing databases from them. It's a very large set of consumer data and all kinds of preferences that goes into this, and it's just incredibly it's incredibly cheap when you think about how valuable that information is. We give this away to marketers for pennies on the dollar, and then in turn we are sorted and resegregated based on it. But I think the other piece of it that you bring up is also right. I mean, there is a very real effort here to, you know, purge voter rolls. There was an interesting set of emails that Reuters found today in a court trial in North Carolina about just how specifically Republicans there have worked to eliminate the Democrats from from voter rolls. And when you look at the combination of voter purges and voter ID laws and absentee ballot restrictions and early voting restrictions, or things like we have seen this year, in which states have gone ahead and done early voting if they have to, but maybe they'll set up, you know, one voting booth, so you have to stand in line for many, many hours. All of this is intentional. All of this is strategic, and I would suggest all of it is deeply anti-democratic. An anti-small D democratic. I don't say this with a partisan thumb on the scale. I say it because I think that the right to vote and is intrinsic to the idea of representative democracy, and that when we mess around with that right for partisan purposes, we harm the fabric of the democracy itself.
Well, thank you for calling. We're actually going to talk about voter suppression on tomorrow's Friday Media Roundtable. And then we will get back to your question, David, about provisional ballots coming up at 11 on our special election show. Kim Alexander with the California Voter Foundation will join us to take questions just like that. So I'll be sure to ask her.
We are all over it.
Yeah, we are all over it, with just 5 days to go until this is all over. Well, and we have other things to deal with, but you know what I mean. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions for David Daley about gerrymandering and redistricting, these are such important issues. Why, with 24/7 coverage of this election, Trump, 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 why can't they take a break and talk about gerrymandering and redistricting? It's so important to note that Democrats got 1.4 million more votes in 2012, but Republicans maintained a majority in the House, 234 to 201. This is such so important. If you have any questions about this, we'd love to hear from you. And Matthew from Piedmont wants to know, why don't the courts deal with gerrymandering?
Well, it's a great question. The courts have never been willing to find a standard for partisan gerrymandering in the past. They have been willing to wade into questions of racial gerrymandering, certainly, and there's a big body of case law there. On the partisan gerrymandering side, the courts have essentially thrown their hands in the air, and they've said, well, drawing of lines is a political activity, and we don't necessarily know when something is a partisan gerrymander or when it isn't. They haven't been able to identify a justiciable standard for it. The last time this comes before the Supreme Court essentially is the Veith case back in the 2000s. And Justice Scalia at the time wanted to say, we've been looking at this for years, let's stop, and let's just say that this court is not willing to find the existence of a partisan gerrymander. And Scalia's side does win the day in this individual case, 5-4, except Justice Kennedy says, well, wait a second, I actually am open to a standard, I just don't see one here that I can use. So if somebody can show me a standard, I am open to considering this. And Justice Kennedy, of course, has been a swing vote for a long, long time, and smart, savvy court watchers and advocates of redistricting noted what he said, and they began preparing cases. And a handful of them are working their way through the courts now. That there's a case in Wisconsin, a case in Maryland, a case in North Carolina, which are all essentially aimed at showing Justice Kennedy a standard for partisan gerrymandering, and a lot of them are highly technical and difficult to explain. But that is the goal of a handful of these cases. And if you can get another justice on the court, you would probably have a 5-4 advantage. But if you could get Kennedy to flip in the meantime, you could probably find a way to deal with this somehow, 5-3.
Well, thank you for that important question, Matt. And let's take one more question before break from Bob in San Francisco. Hi, Bob.
Hi. First of all, I want to thank you so much for your show, Rose. You're my favorite thing on the radio. Love your show.
Thank you.
But my question is this. So far, you haven't explained why it is that the Republicans were able to dominate this redistricting process in 2010 so much. I mean, presumably all that data mining information was available to Democrats as well, and they also hold statewide office. So why was it that in 2010 the Republicans, I mean, were the Democrats just asleep at the wheel, or what happened?
Yes, you're absolutely right.
And Bob, I hope you can, for more information on this, we had David on our show talking in depth about his book, Rat Effed, which is a must read, and you can find that at yourcallradio.org. But David, you have so many interesting, so much information in your book about why this happened, and some Southern politicians went to Nancy Pelosi and said, you need to do something about this.
And Sheena was never willing to do anything about it when the Democrats had power in the House in the late 2000s. The genesis of this, and let me walk you through the history of it as quickly as I can so I don't repeat too much of what we talked about last time, but we redraw district lines every 10 years in this country after the census, and we always have the census in a zero year. There were really smart Republican operatives who were awfully depressed after 2008 when Obama wins. There's a Senate supermajority for the Democrats, and the Democrats hold on to the House. And they said, how are we going to plot our way back? And they said, wait a second, 2010 is a redistricting year. And they got out the rule book in every state, and they said, okay, what do we need to do to be the only people in the room when these lines are drawn? Because every state has got a different process. Different people are involved. In some cases, it's the state, the House leaders and the Senate leaders and the governor. In other cases, it's an apportionment board. They went through in a really savvy way with a plan called Red Map that was run out of something called the Republican State Leadership Committee in Virginia, with about $30 million raised from the Chamber of Commerce and at Walmart and Philip Morris and the like. And they said, how can we dominate the process in every single state and make sure that the Democrats are not even in the room as we're drawing the lines? They identified 104 state House representative seats across the country, state House races, and they spent millions of dollars in these state House races trying to flip control of state legislative chambers in their direction. By the end of 2010, they have something like two-thirds of all of the state legislative chambers in the country. But most important, they take control in Wisconsin, in Pennsylvania, in Michigan, in Ohio, in North Carolina, in all of these blue and purple states. And they shove all the Democrats out of the room when it comes time to drawing new lines. And as we all know, the technology between 2000 and 2010 gets so much better that you're able to draw lines and have computing power that you didn't have in 10 years. I mean, think of how you texted in 2000 versus how you text in 2010. It's all completely changed. And by winning those 104 state House seats, and they won more than that, but those 104 were the key. It was an anti-Obama year. It was a midterm election. Democrats didn't come out to vote. But the Republicans targeted the seats they needed to win to control redistricting, and control it they did. At the end of 2010, Republicans had the ability to draw the lines in 193 of the 435 seats completely on their own. Democrats had the power to draw the lines in just 44 districts completely on their own. So that's a pretty good 193-44 advantage. Just as important, there were 70 seats that NPR identified as being competitive in 2010. Republicans were able to take over the drawing of the lines of 47 of those 70 seats, and they took many of them just completely off the table.
David Daly is publisher of the Connecticut News Project, a watchdog organization covering state politics. In his most recent book, Rat F'd, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy, he explores how Republicans are rigging democracy through redistricting. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may leave a comment at the show's website, set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org, and you can also tweet us at yourcallradio.
Rose Aguilar, coming up during our special election edition of Your Call at 11 o'clock, we will open the lines to take your last-minute questions about what is on the ballot. If you have any questions about absentee voting, your polling place, get those ready and give us a call at 11 o'clock. And then tomorrow, it's our media roundtable, and I'm still here in Bismarck, North Dakota, covering what's happening at Standing Rock. We'll be talking about media coverage of that, and then we will also talk about coverage of voter suppression. Today, we are talking about down-ticket races, gerrymandering, and redistricting. We're also going to follow the money. Today, we're joined by David Daly, publisher of the Connecticut News Project, a watchdog organization covering state politics. His most recent book is Rat F'd, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. And now I would like to welcome Dave Leventhal to the show. Dave is senior reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, a nonprofit investigative news outlet, and Dave leads the center's federal politics reporting team, and they do an excellent job of following the money. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rose. Thanks, Finn, and good to be back with you.
Well, it's great to have you. So, Dave, we've been talking with David Daly about redistricting and gerrymandering. This is such an important issue. Why do you think, with the 24/7 media obsession with this election, we're not hearing much about gerrymandering or redistricting?
Gerrymandering and redistricting is very hot in the moment that it's being done and before it's going to happen, and certainly after everything is said and done and the districts have been rejiggered. Now we have an election, and the fruit of that, whether it's rotten fruit or good fruit, depending on your perspective, is coming to bear. And we have some incredibly fascinating down ballot races that, in the midst of a presidential election unlike anything we've ever seen, have been getting second billing, but yet are going to be incredibly determinative of the balance of power here in Washington, D.C. And there are a number of competitive races, and Democrats certainly think that they are in a position right now to potentially win back the Senate, even win back the House, which seems less likely, but still within the realm of possibility.
And David Daly is telling us that probably just like in 2012, Democrats are going to receive a lot more votes than Republicans, but Republicans will still maintain a majority in the House. Do you agree with that?
If you're a betting person, it's probably a bit more likely that the Democrats are not going to win the House and winning the House, but a lot depends too on what's happening at the top of the ticket. If Hillary Clinton has a huge run and is able to beat Donald Trump in a major way, particularly in states where you also have some very competitive races and whatnot, you have some really, really good prospects for Democrats on all points of the ticket, Senate and House. So that's something that there is a symbiosis between the top of the ticket and the bottom of the ticket. And if there is a wave, a sweep, call it what you want, that's going to point the way of Hillary Clinton, then you do have a lot of Democrats probably feeling a bit better than they would otherwise about their prospects in House and Senate races.
And David Daly, we have a question from Jeffrey who says, what would be a typical reason given when officials are asked directly about the need to redraw lines?
Well, the lines get redrawn every 10 years because
the Constitution mandates that. We want to redraw lines because population shifts, people move, cities grow, the cities shrink, you know, state populations change and grow, and you know, seats are reapportioned to other states. There are lots and lots of great reasons why we do this, and they go, you know, back to the founding of the country. And what I think is important to keep in mind is that whenever you give massively self-interested parties the power to redraw these districts, they will use whatever capability they have to, you know, press their own advantage. I mean, gerrymandering has gone on for years, and certainly both sides have done it. I mean, in California, I mean, Congressman Barton's gerrymander in the 1980s is famous. What I think is so different about what happened in 2010 and 2011 is that the paradigm of gerrymandering is kind of turned on its head a little bit. What had been an incumbent protection racket or an ability to, you know, take maybe an extra seat you didn't deserve or get revenge on an enemy becomes a focused partisan strategy by the Republicans to attempt to get more seats than they would have otherwise deserved based on the vote totals, and to take blue and purple states and make their congressional delegations dominantly red by, you know, packing as many Democrats as you can into as few seats as you possibly can, and then taking all of the surrounding seats for themselves.
And then another quick question about gerrymandering in California. Bill says, didn't a California proposition creating a commission to redraw districts in a fair and nonpartisan manner fix the gerrymandering problem here?
It certainly made the gerrymandering problem in California better, I think. I think even Republicans seem to believe that this process has given them a fighting chance in more districts than it has before. There are a number of states that have passed nonpartisan commissions to do this job, and in those states, you see more competitive races. The Brennan Center just had a study about this released the other day of the handful of competitive races out there. The overwhelming number of them were drawn by nonpartisan commissions, and Florida, Arizona, Ohio. There's a handful of states where there have been ballot initiatives on this in recent years. They are extraordinarily popular. They tend to pass with upwards of 60% of the vote in red states and blue states and purple states. People understand this. I think they get that this is among the reasons why our politics feel so extreme, so broken. We want to have competitive elections, and when citizens have the ability to take that power back, they do it.
And Dave Leventhal, what can you tell us about what's happening in the Senate? That's where the Democrats could flip the balance of party control. The New York Times forecasters currently give the Dems a 59% chance. Which Senate races are you watching closely?
Watching Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, the Nevada Senate race. These are ones that are not only among the most competitive, but also the most expensive, too. Again, we talk all about the presidential race being incredibly costly and all of the different types of political organizations like super PACs and politically active nonprofit groups, these entities that can raise and spend unlimited amounts of money. We talk about how they pour so much money into the presidential race, and they have. But we've been seeing, in fact, we have a big story coming out tomorrow on this very topic, so much money late in the game migrating down ballot to the races that I mentioned, some of the other ones in Florida and Indiana, the Missouri Senate race. These are races that have attracted eight figures, and in the case of the Pennsylvania Senate race, already above $100 million just in that race alone from money that's coming from outside organizations like super PACs, but also the candidates themselves. So, you know, when you think about New Hampshire, for example, little state, not more than barely more than a million people who live in the state, and we're talking close to $100 million that the value of this race in the end is going to be, maybe even cracking that outside chance. So when you put it in those terms, it really drives home the notion that when you have so many forces here in Washington, D.C. and at the national level who care about a race that could flip the balance of the Senate one way or another, it doesn't matter if it's a tiny little state with relatively few people compared certainly to a California or a New York or a Florida or a Texas, New Hampshire is going to be all the rage and will end up being one of the most expensive races among Senate races or House races in the entire nation when all is said and done.
What strikes you about who's spending this money? The Brennan Center is out with a report found that Republicans are winning the outside money battle. Nearly 60% of the money spent so far in top Senate races supports Republican candidates, which is a reversal from 2014. Dark money spending is highly concentrated. We've got just three groups, One Nation with ties to Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican. The Koch Network's Americans for Prosperity and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce account for 67% of all dark money spending.
Well, there's a story to be told behind that 60% number. Yes, Republicans are spending more in Senate races, but a reason among perhaps a couple is that they're spending less at the presidential level. Donald Trump has really been victimized in a way by his own Republican brethren who have decided not to invest in his presidential campaign and instead invest in the futures of Republican Senate candidates. It's a very profound change from what we saw in 2012, where everyone was trying to support Mitt Romney in every way that they could. So when you have the Koch brothers effectively opting out of the presidential race in its entirety and instead investing through their network in Senate races and to an extent House races, that's something that if we were having this conversation a year ago would have seemed absolutely preposterous, but yet it's reality. And there's other big Republican donors who have poured their riches into down ballot races as well. So what has been bad for Donald Trump has been good, at least to some extent, for Republican candidates down ballot. And it's also very much worth noting too that Democrats, although they may be spending less overall in Senate races, have some incredibly impressive super PACs and other groups that have been spending tens upon tens of millions of dollars at the Senate level. And hey, at the presidential level nationally, they've been absolutely handing it to Republicans. And Priorities USA Action, the group that the super PAC that supports Hillary Clinton, the flagship super PAC for her, it's beating everyone. There's no Republican group that is even comparable. So Democrats, both at the congressional level and the presidential level, have embraced sort of the rights and abilities that they have under the Citizens United decision, even while oftentimes advocating against that decision and saying that if they get power, they will change it. At least in the moment, Rose, they are very much embracing it and using it to every extent possible.
Anything strike you about the money that's going to Senate Democrats or House Democrats?
Yeah, well, on the Democratic side, you have a couple of organizations led really on the Senate level by Senate Majority PAC, which is a super PAC that is almost as big as any other at the Senate level, and it's spending tens upon tens of millions of dollars this election cycle and being fueled by a very limited number of individuals and some unions as well. But it's not money that's coming from a Bernie Sanders-style $27 a pop. Instead, it's coming at $2.7 million a pop or whatnot. So you have a number of these organizations, both on the left and on the right, that by virtue of them being able to raise unlimited amounts of money, they go ahead and they do that. And they're fighting a very protracted battle with each other using huge sums of money that are measured in the six and seven and even sometimes eight figures, and are using that as fuel to fire their campaign money machines that are driving up the overall dollar figure of some of these races. And again, going back to a state like New Hampshire, if you're sitting at home watching television or just opening up your mailbox when you come home from work every day, you're being absolutely inundated with messages of every sort, probably to the point where your head's ready to explode. But that's just the nature of politics today. Money will just keep being spent until the day of the election, and done so without regard oftentimes for the sanity of the people who are ultimately going to be able to vote.
And it's always great to leave the Bay Area bubble, because I'm here in North Dakota and I've been watching a little bit of the cable shows, and there are so many Hillary and Trump ads that I do never see at home. Mostly Hillary ads against Donald Trump, which is just really interesting to see, because she's spending a lot of money on TV ads, right?
She's spending an incredible amount of money on TV ads, and when all is said and done, and for that matter at this point in time, in some of the key swing states all around the country, and we're talking Florida, we're talking Pennsylvania, Virginia, North Carolina, Nevada. Hillary Clinton, in some cases, is airing 4, 5, 6, 7 ads, television ads, for every one television ad that Team Trump is doing. And that includes not only Hillary Clinton's campaign, but also super PACs and other organizations that are supporting her. So she has a significant advantage over Donald Trump in terms of money. Her campaign is raising more money than Donald Trump's campaign. The super PACs supporting Hillary Clinton are raising and spending more money than Donald Trump's supportive super PACs. And also, too, the party committees themselves. The Democrats have an advantage at the presidential level over the Republicans. So every way you measure it, Hillary Clinton has more money than Donald Trump, which seems also, too, fairly amazing, given that Donald Trump has talked all along, ever since he became a presidential candidate, about how rich he is and about how much money he's able to spend and how he's self-funded. In the end, Donald Trump may not even spend $100 million on his own campaign, after making predictions in the past that he'd spend $500 million, $600 million. It's not going to reach that, that amount or even get anywhere close, Rose.
Well, and he doesn't really need it, because he's still dominating the news cycle, I mean, even if it's negative coverage.
And that's a great point.
Sure. We have just a couple calls left, and we're almost out of time. I'm sure we will definitely do a post-mortem media show on this election, because there's definitely a lot to talk about right after the election. But let's just go to a few more callers before we have to end. Let's hear from Ryan in San Francisco. Hi, Ryan.
Hi. I was very impressed with the what was said about the ballot initiatives and the fairness commissions. I'd like to hear more about the best practices and solutions of what's working, what can be done to solve the problem. And can it be mandated that redistricting be done with straight lines, or a limited amount of straight lines, like, you know, no more than 6 straight lines or 8 straight lines or 10 straight lines when you redistrict?
All right. David, do you want to take that one?
Sure. That's a good question. I think that if there is going to be a genuine solution to this, it is most likely to come out of the courts, and that there is actual hope to be found in some of these partisan gerrymandering cases that are working their way through Wisconsin, North Carolina, and Maryland right now, as far as really establishing a standard that the courts could look at and say this is within the bounds of reason and this is outside of it. As far as commissions go, commissions, some of them have worked very well and others have simply kind of buried the partisanship at a different level. I mean, I think that California is probably an example of a state where the commission process has worked as well as it possibly can. There is a rigorous essay writing process, an application process. None of this means that, you know, partisans don't get on, or that a lot of money isn't spent by partisans of both sides trying to influence what happens. But the resulting lines have been pretty good. You have certainly seen more competitive elections in California this decade than you have in many decades past. On the other hand, you can look at a state like Florida, for example, which passes a constitutional amendment in 2010 mandating nonpartisan drawing of lines, and the Republicans in Florida simply find a way to run a shadow redistricting process with all of their brightest, highest paid strategists and they work on precise maps, and they funnel all of these maps into the public system through spouses and through neighbors, even through phony email addresses created in the names of former State Party interns. And some of these maps make it exactly into the, you know, final plan. And it is only when a handful of good government groups file suit alleging that the constitutional amendment was violated that all of this, all of these secret machinations are seen and shown. And there's a handful of districts this year that will have new lines that have had to be redrawn because of a furious judge's ruling in this case. But it took 6 years for that to happen. So the public needs to be very watchful. I mean, even putting a commission into place does not guarantee a fair result. We are essentially the only democracy in the world that allows our politicians to pick their own voters, and they really, really like being able to do that and will fight hard to retain that power.
And Dave, what would you add? What are solutions to this issue, ongoing issue?
Well, gerrymandering isn't my area of expertise, although when I talk to folks about gerrymandering, oftentimes it's people who deal in the campaign finance reform world, and I think that there's some parallels to be drawn in terms of that. Some of the things that you just talked about in terms of changes to the way that that districts are drawn, there are parallels with the campaign finance system. For example, I had a conversation recently with Representative Derek Kilmer. He's a Democrat in Washington State, and he would love to see there be similar congressional district redrawing committees that deal with campaign finance matters in states where you have a nonpartisan commission as opposed to partisans on both sides. He'd love to see that at the federal level, so he says, which is sort of an elixir to the Federal Election Commission, which is a bipartisan commission, three Democratic appointees, three Republican appointees, and is oftentimes very gridlocked, and the agency has a host of problems. So since we deal with money a whole lot, oftentimes we're looking at what partisans are doing or political actors are doing in other realms, and congressional redistricting, again, is, I think, has some similarities to campaign finance reform and efforts that are afoot all across the country at the state level and to a lesser extent the national level to do something different than is being done right now in terms of how money is regulated in elections across the country.
Dave Leventhal is senior reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, and David Daly is author of Rateffed, the true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy. Dave and David, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the ongoing mass mobilization against the construction of their $3.8 billion Dakota Access oil pipeline, which Native Americans say will destroy sacred sites and threaten their water supply. We'll also discuss voter suppression. With voting restrictions in place in 14 states, this is the first presidential election without the full protection of the Voting Rights Act in 50 years. Join us at 10 a.m. with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.
On this week's Open Air, I'll talk with the Peninsula Symphony's music director, Mitchell Klein, about the orchestra's concerts this weekend, featuring pianist Conrad Tau and composer Carolyn Bremer, who will also join me in studio. Plus, we'll hear about this weekend's concerts offered by the Golden Gate Symphony and Chorus from music director Urs Leonhardt and soprano soloist Yi Triplett. It's Open Air Thursday afternoon at 1. I'm David LaTulip. Join me here on KALW.
A number of local businesses have provided culinary treats for our volunteers during our recent membership drive, including Casa Sanchez for chips and their famous salsas, and Veritable Vegetable for boxes of organic Satsuma tangerines. Next time you visit them, please thank them for supporting KALW. You can find links to these and our other food donors at KALW.org. KALW San Francisco, it's 11 o'clock.
There are just 5 days until Election Day. It is almost here. On today's special election edition of Your Call, we are opening the lines to take your last-minute questions about what's on the ballot. By now, you've received your ballot guide, which feels more like a phone book, and that's because we're voting on 17 state propositions. Here in San Francisco, we're voting on 25 measures. So what questions do you have? Do you have any last-minute questions about polling places or absentee ballots? We're going to also talk later in the show about specifically what's on the San Francisco ballot. Join us after the news.